it is impossible to get anywhere by reasoning. This is because, as can be shown, monistically there isn't anywhere. Or it is impossible to get anywhere, because one can get everywhere. I can find equally good reasons for laughing, or for being serious, about all this. Holmes tells that he was one of those in the audience, who, though not taking part, went up on the stage, and that he put his hand between Mrs. Richardson and the leader of the string of 13 men, who were almost dislocating one another's shoulder blades, pushing their hardest against her, and that he felt no pressure. So he was convinced not that she resisted pressure, but that pressure could not touch her. Suppose it was that pressure could not touch her. Could blows harm her? Could bullets touch her? Did Robert Houdin have this power, when he faced an Arab firing squad, and is the story of the substituted blanks for bullets only just some more of what taboo is telling everywhere? One untouchable man could own the world except that he'd have a weakness somewhere, or, in general, could be no more than the untouchable toucheable. But he could add to our bewilderments by making much history before being touched. Well, then, if there are magicians, why haven't magicians seized upon political powers? I don't know that they haven't. It may be the secret of fire walking, or that wizards walk over red-hot stones, unharmed, because they do not touch the stones. However, for some readers, it is more comfortable to disbelieve that anybody ever has been a fire walker. For an uncomfortable moment, read an account, in Current Literature, 32-98 exhibition by a Hawaiian fire walker, at Honolulu, January 19, 1901. The story is that this wizard walked on stones of a fierce, red glow, with flames spouting from burning wood, underneath, walking back and forth four times. There is a muscular strength of men, and it may be that sometimes appears a strength to which would apply the description occult, or psychic. In the New York Herald Tribune, January 24, 1932, was reported the death of Mrs. Betsy Anna Tox, of 149 14th Road Whitestone, Queens, NY, who had often performed such feats as carrying a barrel of sugar, weighing 400 pounds, had carried, under each arm, a sack of potatoes, whereas, in fields, usually two men lug one sack, had impatiently watched two men, clumsily moving a 550-pound barrel of salt, in a cart, and had taken it down for them. There are gospel truths, and irrefutable principles, and whatever goes up must come down, and men are strong and women are weak, but somewhere there's a woman who takes a barrel of salt away from two men. But we think in generalizations, and enact laws in generalizations, and women are weak, and, if I should look it up, I'd be not at all surprised to learn that Mrs. Tox was receiving alimony. I now recall another series of my own experiences with what may be my own very wild talents. I took no notes upon the occurrences, because I had decided that note-taking would make me self-conscious. I do not now take this view. I was walking along West 42nd Street, NYC, when the notion came to me that I could see what was in a show window, which, some distance ahead, was invisible to me. I said to myself, "Turkey tracks in red snow." It should be noted that red snow was one of the phenomena of my interests, at this time. I came to the window, and saw track-like lines of black fountain pens, grouped in fours, one behind, and the three others trifurcating from it, on a background of pink cardboard. At last I was a wizard. Another time, picking out a distant window, invisible to me or ocularly invisible to me, I said, "Ripple marks on a sandy beach." It was a show window. Several men were removing exhibits from it, and there was virtually nothing left except a yellow plush floor covering, decoratively. This covering had been ruffled, or given a wavy appearance. Another time, Robinson Crusoe and Friday's footprints. When I came to the place, I saw that it was a cobbler's shop, and that, hanging in the window, was a string of shoe soles. I'm sorry. I should like to hear of somebody, who would manfully declare himself a wizard, and say, "Take it or leave it." I can't do this, because I too well remember other circumstances. Maybe it's my timidity, but I now save myself from the resentment, or the mean envy, of readers, who say, of a distant store window, popular novels, and its pumpkins. My experiments kept up about a month. Say that I experimented about 1,000 times. Out of 1,000 attempts, I can record only 3 seemingly striking successes, though I recall some minor ones. Throughout this book, I have taken the stand that nobody can be always wrong, but it does seem to me that I approximated so highly that I am nothing short of a negative genius. Nevertheless, the first of these experiences impresses me. It came to me when, so far as I know, I was not thinking of anything of the kind, though subconsciously I was carrying much lore upon various psychic subjects. These things may be done, but everybody who is interested has noticed the triviality and the casualness of them. They such as telepathic experiences come and go, and then when one tries to develop an ability, the successes aren't enough to encourage anybody, except somebody who is determined to be encouraged. Well, then, if wild talents come and go, and can't be developed, or can't be depended upon, even people who are disposed to accept that they exist, can't see the good of them. But except that there are adepts, probably they had to go through long periods of apprenticeship, in which, though they deceived themselves by hugely overemphasizing successes, and forgetting failures, they could not impress any parlor, or speakeasy, audience. I have told of my experiments of about a month. It takes 5 years to learn the rudiments of writing a book, selling gents' hosiery, or panhandling. Everybody who can do anything got from the gods, or whatever, nothing but a wild thing. Read a book, or look at a picture. The composer has taken a wild talent that nobody else in the world believed in, a thing that came and went and flouted and deceived him, maybe starved him, almost ruined him, and has put that damn thing to work. Upon November 29, 1931, died a wild talent. It was wild of origin, but was of considerable development. See the New York Herald Tribune, November 30, 1931. John D. Reese had died in his home, in Youngstown, Ohio. Mr. Reese was a healer. He was not a divine healer. He means much to my expression that the religionists have been permitted to take unto themselves much that is not theirs exclusively. Once we heard only of divine healers. Now there are healers. It is something of a start of a divorcement that may develop enormously. Sometime I am going to loot the records of saints, for suggestions that may be of value to bright atheists, willing to study and experiment. Reese had never studied medicine. The only instruction he had ever received was from an aged healer, in the mountains of Wales, when he was a boy. Physicians could not explain his art, and, after satisfying themselves that he was not a charlatan, would shrug, and say simply that he had divine power. But Reese never described himself as a divine healer, and, though by methods no less divine than those of the Salvation Army and other religious organizations, he made a fortune out of his practices, he was associated with no church. He was about 30 years old when he became aware of his talent. One day, in the year 1887, a man in a rolling mill fell from a ladder, and was injured. It was a severe spinal sprain, according to a physician. Mr. Reese stooped and ran his fingers up and down the man's back. The man smiled, and while the physician and the mill hands gaped in wonder, he rose to his feet, and announced that he felt strong again, with not a trace of pain. He went back to work, and Mr. Reese's reputation as a healer was spread abroad. Then there were thousands of cases of successful treatments. Hans Wagner, shortstop of the Pittsburgh Pirates, was carried from the baseball field. One day, something in his back had snapped, and it seemed that his career had ended. He was treated by Reese, and within a few days was back shortstopping. When Lloyd George visited the United States, after the war, he shook hands so many times that his hand was twisted out of shape. Winston Churchill, in a later visit, had what was said to be an automobile accident, and said that he was compelled to hold his arm in a sling. But Lloyd George was so cordially greeted that he was maimed. Doctors said that only months of rest and massage could restore the cramped muscles. Reese shook hands with the statesman, pressed gently, and then harder, disengaged their hands with a wrench, and Lloyd George's hand was strong again. One of the most important particulars in this story of a talent, or of witchcraft, that was put to work, is that probably it was a case of a magician who was taught. Reese, when a boy, received instructions in therapeutic magic, and then, in the stresses of making a living, forgot, so far as went the knowledge of his active consciousness. But it seems that subconsciously a development was going on, and suddenly, when the man was 32 years of age, manifested. My notion is that wild talents exist in the profusion of the weeds of the fields. Also, my notion is that, were it not for the conventions of markets, many weeds could be developed into valuable, edible vegetables. The one great ambition of my life, for which I would abandon my typewriter at any time, well, not if I were joyously setting down some particularly nasty little swipe at priests or scientists, is to say to chairs and tables, "Fall in, forward, march," and have them obey me. I have tried this, as I don't mind recording, because one can't be of an inquiring and experimental nature, and also be very sensible. But a more unmilitary lot of furniture than mine, nobody has. Most likely, for these attempts, I'll be hounded by pacifists. I should very much like to be a wizard, and be of great negative benefit to my fellow beings, by doing nothing for anybody. And I have had many experiences that lead me to think that almost everybody else not only would like to be a wizard, but at times thinks he is one. I think that he is right. It is monism that if anybody's a wizard, everybody is, to some degree, a wizard.